Welcome to the Movies on the Brain podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Brian C. Wood, and with me this afternoon is my co-host, as always,
Chad Mitch.
Welcome to another weird, wild, and wacky week in the world of genre movie news. And thank you to our good friend Jim Baveda from IGN.com, who was kind enough to signal boost our podcast once again and push us to greater numbers. We are always appreciative of that. So, sir, you skipped a podcast. You missed out on the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood talk, but you did see the film.
I did.
And tell me, what were your thoughts about Quentin Tarantino's latest adventure that was better than Spider-Man Far From Home for the 18th time?
yes, it's a better movie, but I still want to see Spider-Man again.
Coming to home video. In October, and then I will get my box set by Christmas.
Yeah, that's your hope.
Yes, I'm really hoping that Sony and Marvel are working out a deal right now.
If Sony has not finalized a deal with Marvel now, they're stupid.
On home entertainment releases?
Yes. I mean, Marvel, slide them a cut of this. Actually, if I'm Marvel, I'd be like, I'm giving you a flat rate. Here, take it. Shut up. Go about your business. And then rake in the money. What? Here's my thing with Sony and Spider-Man. Spider-Man Far From Home made $1 billion this year.
The first Spider-Man movie to make $1 billion and the most profitable Spider-Man ever overseas.
And Sony's last movie to make $1 billion was...
Jumanji.
No. It was Skyfall.
Oh.
And I think... I could be mistaken by this point, but I think that's it. I think it's those two. So you have one franchise that you no longer have. Bond is gone. And you have this one that you could never make $1 billion with. You let the other guys take creative control. They made $1 billion with it. And it's not, I know people will say inflation, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, but if you look at the number of people that have actually bought tickets to see the movies, the progression is upward from... Far From Homecoming to Far From Home. The projection you want to see. Factor in, it made $1 billion like that. When your movie division, let's look at the other movies that had come out this year. One was, I know, Men in Black. Can't think of anything else. Once Upon a Time, which started this whole conversation, is one that's going to be successful. But that's it. What you take what you can get. I know you don't want to be in that position, but Sony, this is where you're at. Marvel, as long as Marvel's not really like, from a business standpoint, as long as Marvel's really not trying to rake you over the coals, you kind of have to do what they say. Now, as a fan of this Spider-Man, if Marvel wants to rake you over the coals, well, you hand them the rake. That's what has to happen. But as the company, you can't like walk into that. I understand. So all that to say, Sony needs to not do anything stupid.
There hasn't been a box set released for Phase 3, and there certainly hasn't been the Infinity Saga set. We all assume that the reason you created that logo was because you're going to brand merchandising.
Oh, yeah.
So we know that you have a Phase 1 and Phase 2 box sets, but Homecoming did not come into effect till Phase 3.
Mm-hmm.
So you're in a position where... You haven't had to answer this question about whether or not Marvel could include the Sony the Sony Spider-Man movies in their DVD collection of their MCU movies, which are all self-owned. Because Marvel technically doesn't own the rights to Spider-Man. Sony owns the rights to Spider-Man. They're just sharing. And Sony, under the purview of that agreement, gets all the funds from solo Spider-Man movies. One would assume that would include home video releases. So I am under the impression that legally a deal has to be struck between Marvel and Sony as far as home video return in order to include it on a box set, which I'm hoping has already occurred because you need to pump that thing out for Christmas.
Yeah. When did we get the box sets for the first phase?
So originally the first phase box set was supposed to come out in November. After Avengers, so November of 12,
mm-hmm.
But because of the licensing issue with the suitcase and having to get that civil lawsuit squared away, It didn't happen until the following April, so April of 13,
okay.
Like a month before Iron Man 2, 3 came out. And then the Iron Man, the Infinity Gauntlet, the Phase 2 box set was November, right before Christmas.
Okay. So yeah, so November seems to be the target date. So,
And that's after we're all unanimously agreed that Far From Home is the end of Phase 3,
mm-hmm.
and that Black Widow is the beginning of Phase 4. So that would mean that now, you know, I think Sony announced a mid-October home video release for Far From Home. Then that's another month or so away from the box set release. Let's just say it's just in time for Black Friday. And you go from there. I hope it's on Black Friday because I'm going to need some kind of deal because I'm going to have to refinance my home in order to buy it. So
yeah, that's what, 22 movies? 22 Blu-rays?
23s.
23. That's right, because Endgame was 22. So 23 movies, 23 Blu-rays, no less.
Well,
fancy case.
23 DVDs, 23 Blu-rays. And if there were any of them that were still printed in 3D...
All of those came in...
Some of those did. The Phase 1 and Phase 2, there were some 3D releases there. So you would throw the 3D copy in there. You would have digital download codes for each and every one of them. You would have, you know, and of course the assumption would be you would utilize the Infinity Gauntlet design, whether that would be for the Phase 3 set. My contention for a while has been you would use Thanos' Infinity Gauntlet design for the Phase 3 set, and then use Tony's Infinity Gauntlet design for the Ultimate Infinity Saga set. So, I mean, the price point on the individual sets was already sort of around $200. The price point for the, you know, ultimate 23 movie set is probably going to be somewhere around $300.
Yeah.
That's about where the Bond set came when it was first released for the 50th anniversary.
Yeah, I can't see them going any higher than that. Interesting that you said they would have, you know, Phase 3 and then the Ultimate Phase. Which makes sense.
Double billion.
Yeah.
Double billion. Because if I'm me and I need my set to finish my collection, I'm darn sure going to go pick up the Phase 3 set. And then I'm going to drop another $300 in 2020 for the Ultimate set. And then I'm going to have dual copies of every Marvel movie.
Yeah, that is a good way to get you.
And it's perfect because who buys physical media anymore?
Me.
Like, this is the only way you're going to make massive amounts of money off of physical media sales.
Yeah, this will get people that don't buy physical media to buy it if you give it... I mean, you make it special and you give it the case.
And you drop it around Christmas.
Yeah. It would entice me, even though I have all of them except for, like, 3 physically. No, about 4 physically. That is a thought to double dip on that. Bravo to they should take you up on that.
Well, if they want to take me up on that, there are a few other ideas I have they need to take me up on. But let's circle back around to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Mark Sanchez did not have a cameo in this movie. He was busy being a football player. He is now retired. Rest in peace. So let's talk about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
How did we get there? I'm not going to meander off that one. All right. So for about half of this movie, I thought it was a...
hangout movie.
I thought it was a well-directed, well-acted movie that was just like, where the hell are we going? Like, there's no story structure that people, when people think of movies, they think of, like, you know, the typical story structure and like an inciting incident or anything. No, there's nothing, none of that. It's just these three people doing stuff.
Day in the life.
Pretty much, yeah. Day in the life. And it helped that I really like Brad Pitt's character. I enjoy Leonardo's character, particularly, like, you know, he's the washed up TV star still trying
Cliff
to
and Rick.
Yeah, trying to find his way and knowing that he's on his way out and how he handled that, because he has some particularly good scenes, like the. Him shooting the heavy scene in the Western, that whole thing, like when he forgets his lines and he goes in the trailer and throws a tantrum and all that stuff, is like, I never thought of anybody going through that when shooting a scene. Like, but this is probably happening. This, so, and how he reacts to the little girl and when she makes him cry, saying it's the best acting you ever seen. I thought all of that was great. Saying all of that, the movie was still killing me because it was just going and going and nothing was happening up until we get to the ranch.
The last, well, the ranch, and then the last 15 minutes.
Is the, well, the ranch pulled me back in because there was a point where I started to like
meander,
started to hit the little
that apocalypse place.
Yeah, it didn't help that I was freezing and it was like, oh, I'm nodding off. And then he got to the ranch. Oh well, then he picked up the girl. And that led to the ranch. And we got to see Tarantino do his tension-filled scenes, which he's really, really good at. Because I really didn't want to watch that thing. Because I was like, he's going to die. It's going to be some gruesome thing I'm not prepared for. I don't want to watch this. And just the way he built that whole scene and how it all came together, that woke me up. But still, then we meandered again a little bit. But I was awake enough from that point till we get to until you realize that we're getting to the night of the actual Manson murders and we see what happens. So and the last 15 minutes, I am so glad I was the only one in the backseat of the theater. I had that whole row to myself because I was on the edge of my seat and I was like, really? You've watched movies with me. I don't really do anything. I just kind of sit there. I was like on the edge of my seat and I was like really animated on how this was going, because it meandered enough that it lulled me into the sense of this is not a Tarantino movie. I'm not even thinking about violence or grotesque deaths or anything like that. And then the last 15 minutes happens. Like, no, we're still in a Tarantino movie. This is what happens. I'm like, all right, okay. So overall, it's a good movie. It's got some things that people may gonna like. I'm not as offended by them as some. I think some of it is stupid, but I can see where they're coming from. But overall, I like the movie. It's one that I want to watch again, but it's gonna be a while because again, that's like a chunk of my life I'm giving up to watch this again.
I saw it on back-to-back nights.
Jesus Christ!
I saw it on back-to-back nights, and I'm threatening to go see it again before it leaves. So a couple of things. One, what did you think when he went into the pool house? What did you think was coming out of that pool house?
When Leonardo went to the pool house?
Yeah.
I didn't think anything of it. Like I saw him go in there. I didn't know what
thought he was gonna run and hide?
Yeah, I thought he was gonna run and hide. And then when he came out, I'm like, duh, you should have known that was coming out
2.5 hours ago.
We saw Leonardo with a flamethrower. It's like as soon as he walked back out, I'm like, why didn't you see this? He told you this 2.5 hours ago. This is coming back.
And trained for a week with that thing.
Yeah,
can we do something about this heat?
Yeah, we saw him use it. We saw him train with it. He talked about it again. It was like, I'm telling you that you're going to see this again, and I completely forgot. And when he came out, I was like, all right. And that was the whole time. I'm like, you're in the pool, girl. Just go to her.
Well, she already been.
I mean, she'd already been like, I mean, she'd been mangled at this point. I understand. But it's like, and I figured at a certain point, the shock just kicks in and she's just there. But it's like, even the water.
I'm just absolutely amazed at the fact that, like, she had her skull just literally bounded in repeatedly and she was still able to run flailing, screaming into the pool.
Yeah, and when she got out there, I'm like, damn, I know she's about to die. Is she going to take him with her? And at first I thought, because he dropped the radio, I was like, all right, is this one of those electrocution things? But she's still walking. That means he can't die in this either, so we're good. And then he ran in the shed. I'm like, he's just going to run in the shed until Cliff comes out. Nope. Flamethrower to the head.
Yeah. Literal lake of fire.
Yeah, it really was. That was...
And the acid trip.
Yeah. Yeah, when he smoked the... When that cigarette came back at the end, I'm like, all right. I still thought they were going to go... He was going to bring it to Sharon's house. But Cliff was going to get involved. she wasn't going to die. But I didn't think it was going to go well for Cliff because he was tripping. I didn't know he was just like, no, we're just going to bring it over. We're going to bring it over to well, his name's not Cliff.
Ricks,
yeah. Yeah, Rick Dalton. Yep. Remember Rick fucking Dalton? Yeah. So I knew that he was going. I knew he was going to Inglourious Basterds this. I didn't think he was going to do it this way. And I thought. I mean, they might get taken out, but I figured he was going to kill like one of them. But to just like brutally murder all of them and the dog.
Yes. So, what say you about the Bruce Lee scene? Is the Bruce Lee scene a flashback, or is it a daydream?
So originally, I just thought it was a flashback, what made me really think it was just a flashback was the fact that at the end of it, when Cliff is like, well, fair enough, because what prompts it is Rick telling him that he can't work on the shoot because the guy's a friend of the guy that worked on the Green Hornet.
Which Leo says at the very beginning when he's meeting Pacino that he lists off Land of the Giants and some of the TV shows he had done.
And he says Green Hornet. And then Cliff goes and recalls the incident. And since he's recalling it in a way like, okay, so this happened and this is why this guy doesn't like me. And for him to, at the end of it, come to like, yeah, I guess it was my fault. It made it seem like he was
having a moment of introspection.
Yeah, and that was a completely true memory from him. I've since heard other people talk about it, and almost nobody's a reliable narrator when it comes back to thinking upon memories like that. So that opens it up that it could be Rick's Cliff's embellished memory of it, still taking fault, but making it worse than what it was, particularly on Bruce's side.
Well, it was going to be even worse, because Bruce was going to lose, straight up, in Tarantino's original version. So all of those individuals who are very pissed off right now that...
Oh, they would have been livid.
Uh-huh. That some Hollywood stuntman beat Bruce Lee.
I haven't listened to everybody else's criticism. The only one I really took to heart was...
his niece.
His daughter. It was his daughter. And how that scene made her feel. Like, watching it, I don't know Bruce Lee as well as everybody else. I know Enter the Dragon, but I don't know, like... I personally never saw, like, the introspective... you know, how he's revered now. So seeing that, it's like, yeah, it's a caricature. But I don't... It wouldn't... If she hadn't said that, I wouldn't have thought anything of it. I would have just thought, like, okay, they're embellishing this. But listening to her talk about how she saw her father and how other people saw her father and, like, he wasn't this braggadocious kind of guy. That made me take it to heart. I respect what she says. Not that I don't respect what everybody else says, but I really put weighted value in what she's saying about it.
Indeed. I want to live in the alternate reality that Tarantino creates here. She lives. She has her baby. She presumably stays married to Roman for a period of time, potentially keeping Roman out of his trouble that he gets into, which potentially leads to more Roman Polanski films going forward, which God knows what those could have been. You end up with, although it's implied kind of that it was an open marriage.
Yeah.
But she lives, she has her baby, that baby grows up to have some kind of life and career. Rick Dalton gets to be in the next Polanski movie, more than likely.
Yeah, more likely.
So it boosts his career back up, so he doesn't have to sell the house, so he doesn't have to move, so that means that he can continue to employ Cliff, which means Cliff continues to have a job and continues to make money. Because no one else in Hollywood will hire him because he murdered his wife.
That so you think he murdered his wife?
I don't, but that's the that is the most frustrating. I know what they're doing. They're parroting Robert Wagner's situation there.
Oh, with West Side Story.
Natalie Wood?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I didn't even catch that. I
know what they're doing there, and I get what they're doing there, but because it was just him and more cowbell guy.
Christopher Walken.
Yeah, on the boat. But that was the one scene that kind of aggravated me about the movie, because it's like, this is useless information. Like, unless you're going to show us her getting harpooned, you're just totally leaving it up to us and our interpretation of whether or not we think he actually killed her.
I mean, we could have did that without having that scene. Yeah,
except it's not an excuse to get Brad Pitt into spandex. Which, when you have the shot of him taking his shirt off on the roof,
I mean, that was enough.
Right.
He's 50 and he looks like that. Good. Good for him.
But I'd like that. Like, I'd like to live in that reality where, you know, Cliff has intimate knowledge of the ranch. He knows that the kids are out there and he knows what they're doing to George. And so, being interviewed by the police about what happened at Rick's house, he could very easily, once he comes off of this high, tell them about the ranch, which would then cause them to go out there and get Manson and put him in jail before he can actually commit any kind of serious atrocity with him and his followers, which prevents, you know, countless acts of violence and murder, and he probably isn't as world famous as he becomes. He's just another guy in jail.
Which I think that's like the whole point of this movie, is just to take that narrative away from Manson, because, I mean, he doesn't deserve it.
Well, he's in one scene.
Yes.
And that's a meandering around trying to trace the house. He's not at the ranch when Cliff goes to the ranch, mm-hmm. and he isn't the one who goes out onto the hillside to kill the people in the houses. So he's really only in it for one scene. We're going to get an extended 4-hour cut of this thing on Netflix at some point. Yeah. So maybe there is some more, you know, Manson footage there. But, I mean, the whole thing is basically, to me, I want to live in that alternate reality where Cliff ends up as, you know, keeping his job. Rick gets employed for a couple of more, you know, years. And Sharon lives out her days. Her child, you know, lives out their days. And Roman stays out of trouble and produces more films. Because that I think would be an interesting world to go into the 70s with.
Yeah, Tarantino does a good job of making these alternate reality kind of things.
Well, this to me is different because, like, no one's going to debate whether or not it's a good thing to blow Hitler's head off.
Well, in the context of having Charles Manson, I don't think anybody would debate that stopping that particular murder would probably leading to Manson being captured would be a bad thing either. So, I mean, clearly Hitler's the worst of the two.
Right, but Manson went to jail. Manson was never murdered himself. Mm. This way, Hitler allegedly pulled his own trigger, right?
Yeah.
So, like, this would have just literally saved the world from ever knowing Manson existed, basically. Because, yeah. You know, he got fame and notoriety for the atrocity that was those killings. Murdered a pregnant woman and basically dismembered her. I mean, it's brutal.
Now, okay, so you know about Sharon Tate and the murders. I know about Sharon Tate.
And that's the problem that people under 30 are going to have with this film. Not only is it a hangout movie, not only is it just really a day in the life of these three characters in February, and then we pick up with another night in the lives of these characters in August of 1969. But it is predicated on our knowledge. The ranch scene is a good example. The ranch scene is entirely built upon... The tension in that scene is totally built upon the fact that you and I know that that's the Manson family ranch. Mm. And that Charlie is Charlie Manson. And that those women are dedicated to him. They're not just crazy psychedelic women who grow their armpit hair out. Like, they are trained by a psychopath to be killers. And so we know that. And so that's what leads to our assumption mentally that George was murdered and they just took mm-hmm. over the ranch. Which leads to the fact that if they've already murdered the old man, they'll be more than happy to murder this guy and just throw it as another body into the California desert. So that's the only way that scene works, is if you have the tension of knowing why they're trying to keep him from getting into the house and why that what they are prepared to do if he makes a ruckus. Mm. If you don't have that foreknowledge, it's just another, you know, cool scene.
Yeah.
And the same way, like, if you see August 8th, 1969 pop up on the screen when they come flash forward, you don't really know what... I mean, the moon landing was July 20th. I mean, you don't really know any, like, firm date of from 69 unless it is that.
And honestly, I didn't know the date. But because I know what's going on, when they put the date up, I'm like, okay, so this is the date. And really and truly, Charles Manson has always been in, like, the public consciousness for me. I didn't know exactly what happened until, like, a few years ago when I looked it up for some...
Yeah.
For some... Well, whatever reason. That's how I found out about Sharon and everything that happened.
Well, Sharon is a part of that legacy for me simply because of Hollywood and because of Hollywood history and Hollywood culture. And she is one of those great what-would-have-happened-if starlets... You know, you get some of that with James Dean, right? If James Dean wouldn't have gone loved fast cars and gone really fast, if he had lived longer, what kind of movies would he have done? What kind of actor would he have been? You get some of that in music with Buddy Holly. You know, what would have happened if the plane wouldn't have crashed and he'd have kept making music? She was always in that genre in Hollywood as a great rising star actress and what kind of film she could have done, especially with the Artur movement that was coming in the 70s, of which her husband was a huge part, along with Woody Allen. What kind of movies could she have made? And so I was aware of her and aware of what happened through that. And that prism, I mean, that was the whole conversation when the movie was announced, right? People freaking out that he was doing the Manson family murders from the perspective of the Mansons, and that he was going to show all this the gory deaths, and he was going to praise Manson for what he was doing. And it couldn't be anything further than the truth.
Yeah.
But my concern is that when I've seen people 25 and younger, 30 and younger, talking about this movie, A, they're bored out of their minds. Because there's no plot. There's literally no plot. And it's literally a hangout movie. You have to fall in love with these characters, otherwise you're going to be bored to death. You have to have some knowledge of spaghetti westerns, and you also have to have some knowledge of movie making. Because, like, you have to understand, like, when they move the dolly back, that they're just restarting the scene from the beginning. And you have to be smart enough to pick up on the fact that, like, DiCaprio, when he's mixing his drinks, is practicing his lines. They had taped those lines and he was repeating them back, and that's why he was learning his stuff. So that when you hear that dialogue again in the cantina, you understand what you're seeing. Those are all problematic for a younger generation to hook their teeth into, whereas something like Django is action set piece, action set piece, action set piece. Or Inglourious Basterds is the action set piece, action set piece.
Yeah, if there was like a semblance of a plot, I think people would... It wouldn't be that much. Because you cannot know about these things, but if there's a bit of a plot to it, even if it doesn't explicitly say who these people are, there gives you something to follow. So when you get to the end, you're like, you're not bored out of your mind. And you probably appreciate the end more, but there is something for people that know and watch this and know, and knowing without the movie telling you, I think it helps with the sense of dread, particularly like at the ranch. But like for general moviegoers to enjoy, it limits them if they have no knowledge of it.
And it's gonna be his highest grossing movie ever. 75 million going after this weekend. It was looking to push 100. So that's, you know, not bad on a $35 million budget.
Better.
So, there's a reason studios were fighting to get Tarantino's movie after Miramax and Winston Weinstein had closed up. All right, so let's move on to something a little less serious and less artistic and less crafty. Dwayne The Rock Johnson has officially retired from professional wrestling, which should come as no surprise to anybody considering his last official match in WWE occurred at WrestleMania 32. We are coming up on WrestleMania 36. So The Rock made a little movie called Hobbs and Shaw because he was pissed off at his good friend Vin Diesel. And they made a solid B movie. Your thoughts?
So, I didn't see the movie?
No, of course, because as we've established on this podcast, you are yet to sit and watch all of the Fast and the Furious movies. The last one I had to drag you to.
Yes, and, yes, you did. And I forgot. I hadn't forgot. I clearly remember that.
Yes. It's been ages since we've sat in a movie theater together and watched a movie and done a podcast immediately following.
It has been.
And we need to do that, but I wanted specifically to do that with that Fast and the Furious movie because you had never seen one. And granted, I'm also a sadist and I made you watch XXX3, so.
I didn't forget that either. You're a terrible person. Just
skiing through the mountains.
So I didn't forget the experience, but I forgot the movie. And so don't tell me anymore, so I don't have to remember. Look, my comments about Hobbs and Shaw are going to be nothing to do with the movie and everything to do with everything around it. Being that when The Rock joined the Fast franchise, the cool thing to say was The Rock is franchise Viagra because he brought the Fast and Furious. He came back in, Fast and Furious took off. So I know we're like 6 years down the road from that, but while this was a solid opening, it's
box office wise, it's probably gonna end up finishing above Tokyo Drift,
which is the worst one overall, period.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems that maybe the actual Fast proper name is a bigger draw than people were like originally giving it credit to being. And
well, that's going to be a problem for Mr. Johnson, because Mr. Johnson and his crew have clearly set up a second team in this Fast and the Furious universe that's supposed to battle this unseen enemy organization that wants to wipe out half the human planet with its stuff. Look, my biggest, I loved like the banter between the two of them, but I liked the banter between the two of them in the original Fast franchise. Look, I get it. Toxic set. Two stars can't even shoot scenes together. It's a producer and a director's nightmare. I mean, when you got Morgan and Gray going back and forth between the two, trying to negotiate a peace accord so you can get everybody in the same room to shoot a damn scene, I can imagine what that's like to go through for 4 months. Like, that cannot be fun. But one of the biggest pieces to all of this is the introduction of Statham's character into the Fast and the Furious franchise is a stinger at the end of Fast and the Furious 6, in which he is shown to have been the murderer of Han in the car crash that resulted at the end of, in Tokyo Drift. It retconned Tokyo Drift and therefore retconned the movies 4, 5, and 6 as being before 3.
Mm.
I know, complicated. Stay with me. So, now that he's come full circle and done the face turn, as we like to say in wrestling, and he's joined the family and he helped get Toretto's baby out of the plane in the last one, which was kind of hilarious. And people have kind of started to take a like to him, and him and The Rock have been going back and forth in this nice little way. He's kind of been brought in as a face. The problem with that is that people, as we have for, you know, Barb and Bob, we now have had Justice for Han as a hashtag for two movies now, for Fast 7 and for Fast 8. We've gotten no justice for Han. So, how are we ever going to get justice for Han if Statham isn't on set right now somewhere in London filming Fast 9? Which will, by the way, be the first Fast and the Furious movie with no Chris Morgan script. So we will see how well that works, as I have a feeling Mr. Morgan's going to be flown to set to do some polishing at some point. But how do we get justice for Han if he's over here with his team that includes Ryan Reynolds, The Rock, Statham, his sister, who he's 30 years older than, and his mom, like, and Kevin Hart? How are we supposed to, like,
Kevin Hart's in this movie?
Kevin Hart is in this movie.
What?
Yes. This movie basically boils down to, like, The Rock and David Lynch, like, making phone calls and getting their friends to come bail their asses out. Because, like, you get Ryan Reynolds, who, you know, has a little bit part in it and has a good arc, but it's a small part. And you get, you know, Kevin Hart in a cameo role. And you get, you know, you get Helen Mirren in a cameo role. You know, it's just, it's a lot of, like, here are some familiar faces that you might want to see if you continue to support this movie. So my thing is, like, if you've got that team and you're going to roll with this evil organization that has a history with Hobbs and now has a history with the Shaws, well, how's that supposed to reconcile with Fast 9 and 10, which The Rock has already stated he won't, him and Statham at least won't be a part of 9. Because that just started shooting a month or two ago.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you get justice for Han if you aren't in the movie? And you've got the producers running around saying there will be justice for Han.
You know how there will be justice for Han. In this ridiculous-ass franchise, you know the best way they can get justice for Han.
Han coming back and
kill him. There it is! Han comes back. He's not going to kill him, but he's going to come back. He's going to join this little team over here, and they all come back together in Fast 10 and be one big happy freaking family.
Fast 10 is supposed to be in space, man. It's the only way you can go. Vin Diesel running a dinosaur on the moon. That's about the only way that you can...
Don't put that out into the world, because it might come back. I don't want it to come back. Take it back. Don't ever do anything like that again.
Vin Diesel riding a muscle car on the back of a T-Rex... on the moon.
I'm gonna just drink this lemonade and pretend you didn't say any of that.
Mm-hmm. It's okay. It's Pepper Potts approved. So,
God damn it.
So let's move on from the Hobbs and Shaw. Look, decent money. We'll see what happens. There's not much coming out for the rest of August. You got the Dora the Explorer movies and Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark this week. You've got Where'd You Go, Bernadette coming next week. But it's a quiet August, so there is the potential it could just have legs and run till we get to that first week of September, which is, you know, award season and TIFF. And
I mean, it's making regular Rock money, so I mean, that's not bad.
It's better than Skyscraper. It's better than Rampage. It's better than San Andreas.
Very true. All very true.
So let's move on to the box office conversation then. You know, Disney has a few properties.
A few?
Hobbs and Shaw did dethrone them this week.
Yeah, dethrone them.
Dethrone, meaning they have three of the top five and not just all five.
I mean, technically, Disney only had... They have two of the top five. That's it. Because Hobbs and Shaw came in. Lion King stayed number two. Then we have two Sony movies. Three and four, Once Upon a Time and Spider-Man. You know, Spider-Man is the forever asterisk in all this. Mm-hmm. And then Toy Story 4. God, Aladdin is still in the top 10. This thing just won't.
No, it won't. You know, I heard an argument that Robin Williams is blessing the movie and that's why it's doing so well.
It's not. Look, out of the remakes, especially the recent remakes, I like it the best. Like, if I had to go pick... Honestly, there was a point this summer I wanted to go back and see Aladdin.
So you've got what? You've got Maleficent, Cinderella, Beauty and the Beast. You've got Jungle Book. Mm-hmm. You've got Aladdin. You've got Aladdin. You've got...
Lion King.
Anything else? That's six off the top of my head.
Dumbo,
that would be seven.
Those damn Alice in Wonderland movies.
And the two Alice in Wonderland movies.
I think that's it.
That's nine movies. So where out of those nine would you put it?
Aladdin?
Top three?
Three or four, yeah. I think Cinderella and Jungle Book. I would go Jungle Book, Cinderella as the top two. And then probably Aladdin after that.
Jungle Book benefits from having no expectations of a fan base. It's a movie that was made in the 50s, late 50s, early 60s, that's most popular for I Want to Walk Like You.
Well, if...
Or Bare Necessities.
You ever watch Honest Trailers?
Yeah.
Okay, so the Honest Trailers of Jungle Book, is completely accurate. It is a collection of scenes that is barely strung together, and people don't remember them because they remember the songs. That's it. So when New Jungle Book came out, they actually made it a coherent story all the way through, and that is why it is probably the best one out of the bunch, because it didn't follow the cartoon, because the cartoon is just like
scenes strung together.
Yeah.
But same time, that those scenes strung together didn't have a huge fan base. Unlike The Lion King, where you have...
Oh, no, no, no. Yeah, nothing like this, yeah.
Which is my argument for why Favreau's Jungle Book is better than his Lion King.
I would agree that. That is definitely true. Like, I don't hate that Lion King. Let me say never. I'm not going out of my way to watch it again. I'll probably buy the damn thing because my kid likes it. But other than that, I'm not, like, going out of my way to try to see it.
I mean, Tarantino having the highest grossing opening weekend of his career. Hobbs and Shaw making okay money. I think it was $60.2 million for the opening weekend.
Yeah.
And that's an okay number for early August. And Toy Story is going to eventually cross that billion-dollar threshold as well.
It's going to be... It's a long march. They're
at 850?
No, they're at 961.
961. So 30 more million. But, I mean...
They should... I mean, it's not going to get pulled until it comes out. It's probably not coming out on Blu-ray until the end of September at earliest, so...
It's possible. But, I mean... Disney is only going to be worse going forward now owning Fox, because you have more stuff to put out.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In other news, we are awaiting with bated breath the rescue movie that's going to be announced as part of Phase 5.
I'm not doing this with you.
The Marvel Cinematic
Universe. Not doing this with you. The only thing I can say for certain is that Gwyneth Paltrow said, I will come back to do Marvel movies if Robert Downey Jr. comes back. Well, we know what happened to him, so it's over. It's on.
She said she'd come back for a day if they wanted her to do a cameo shoot. She'd be willing.
No.
There's only one character anyway who is tied to her now, and that is Spider-Man, because his connections to Happy.
Yeah, but she can't remember being in those movies. So
she can't. Well, Chef. It's a good show on Netflix.
It is a good show. I really enjoy it.
Favreau loves to cook.
He does, and it's got me into cooking now.
So let's talk about Marvel, since I negotiated us there. There's a guy named Andy Serkis who did a really dark version of the Jungle Book.
That is not Marvel. I see what you're trying to do here. That is not Marvel.
That is Marvel.
No.
That is a Marvel Comics character.
Yes, it's a Marvel.
Propagated through Sony Pictures Entertainment.
But we go through the box office talking about Marvel, and everybody assumes we're talking about Marvel proper. And then you slide in that Venom thing, and you will confuse people and make them think, wait, so is Marvel Comics actually doing something with... No, they're not. This is not that. This is Sony Marvel. You gotta keep that straight. This is not Marvel Studios. This is Sony Marvel. The ones that do dumb things, they're over here. Marvel is over here. You gotta keep those things separated.
So Andy Serkis did a really dark version of the Jungle Book using mocap technology that no one saw because the studio dumped it to Netflix because they were so afraid of taking a bath on it after having it done for 5 years. And he did a little small movie called Breathe, which made some money, but was, critically panned. He's, the mocap aficionado of all of Hollywood, the man who deserves an honorary Oscar just for the Apes franchise alone.
He does.
And he had been doing some consulting work through his mocap firm for the first Venom movie. And now they've just made him director. Your thoughts on it being true that he's got the Venom in him?
So this frustrates me because they insist on trying to bring in good, competent people to make this movie that I am just vehemently against. I just don't want this movie, this now franchise, to exist. I don't want it to be a thing, and yet they're trying to make it a thing. So
while the iron's hot, baby.
So since it is a thing, I do think the choice of Andy Serkis is a inspired one because of his mocap work, and he can probably do some good things with Venom and...
And his working relationship with Carnage.
Yeah, and since we're going to get Carnage, yeah, all of that can be his expertise in bringing those two together will probably be beneficial to the movie. That's where my good things stop. I don't have anything else good to say about this because, again, I don't want this to exist.
You're not going to try and pull Tom Holland into it.
Which, see, and this is why I don't want it to exist. Forget the fact that I've had this image of how Venom should appear in the movies, and you can do it really good, and you can have some real good tension and all this stuff, but Sony keeps pissing it all away because they got to just throw Venom in there. They're like, Warner Brothers with a certain other thing they like to do. I'll get to them later. But they can't leave well enough alone. It's like you have a kid and the kid just wants to do something that you know they can't do and you know it's going to be a catastrophe. Like, let's say the kid wants to, let's say you got a, why would you have a bowl of flour for a kid? I don't know. We're just going to say he has a bowl of flour. And the kid just wants to put the bowl of flour up. And it's a little short kid. And you already know, if the kid puts the bowl of flour up there, he's going to dump it all over the place. It's going to be a mess. But he's so adamant that he has to do it, you let him do it. And it results in said mess. And when it results in said mess, somebody else walks into the room and thinks it's the cutest and the most adorable thing they've seen. And it then validates the kid for even trying because, look, I pleased this person by making this mess while you're standing over here like, I knew he was going to make this mess. That's why I wanted him to do it. So what he does then proceeds to do is to take his flowery ass all over the place and make the mess everywhere instead of containing it to right there. And that person is still entertained by this and the kid is still emboldened. And while you're just sitting there pulling your hair out like, I've got to clean up all this crap because they're just letting this happen. That is what this whole situation is like. Sony had to be emboldened and had to make Venom, and it made it a almost dumpster fire of a movie that was successful, that people went and paid money to see. And now they're like, well, we got to do it again. We got to spread all the love all over the place. And you're just sitting there like, my house was fine. And then this happened. And it's your fault for supporting this thing that I knew was going to happen. That's where I'm at with them.
Coming to theaters 2021.
They're going to shoot this year?
And you also have a Morbius movie to look forward to. This is your reminder that that's a thing.
See,
we'll be getting the first trailer with Joker.
I wish that movie was coming out before Venom 2 would start shooting, so they can have some pause when Morbius falls flat on its face, because it's going to fall flat on its face. If you're listening to this, you're probably saying, but you said the same thing about Venom. Yeah, I did. And you know, under normal circumstances, I'd have been right. But I forget, you little 90s monsters just love Venom and go see it. Go flop in the theater anyway just to see Venom, no matter how good or bad it is, instead of staying home. Morbius? How many of y'all out there like Morbius? How many of y'all know who Morbius is? If it's not for the animated series from the 90s, do you know who Morbius is? The answer to all of those things is no. So that's going to tell you how good this movie's going to do. I mean, it doesn't even benefit from having a star that people like Tom Hardy. It's Jared Leto. Nobody likes him these days, but he's your Morbius. Good luck with that, son.
I'm sure he left bats in people's dressing rooms as gifts.
Oh, boy. Yeah, this...
I mean, you can't fault him for trying to rush things. I mean, strike while the iron's hot, and you get a mocap director for a mocap character. I get it. It kind of works. I mean, you're going to bring Michelle Williams back. You're going to bring Hardy back. You're going to bring Woody Harrelson in. I'm thoroughly convinced the only reason Ruben Fisher signed on to direct the thing in the first place was that if it so happened to break out and make money,
he
could do Zombieland 2, and then he could take his political capital and do that, and which he did. And we'll see how well another horror comedy sequel does, because the comedy sequels in general, a decade later, are hard to do.
Yeah.
But then again, getting that cast is, again, really hard to do when all four of your leads have either been nominated for or won the Academy Award.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see about that. And Morbius, like I said, we expect our first footage to come right before the Joker premiere. So let's move on to Marvel Cinematic Universe news. You like that, Chad?
Yeah, that's better.
The Eternals is going to continue to cast. We were told that after Comic-Con that they were not finished casting, that they still had a few major roles to pull out. But they just wanted to, you know, announce it and bring out the majority of their cast, which they did. So we got two more names added this week. Barry, you want to pronounce that last name?
No, I don't. Coing something? Keoing? I'm sorry, guy. He's in Dunkirk.
Yes. The Irish actor who was the kid who was on the boat with his neighbor and ended up dead, or dad and ended up dead. Mm. He was in Chernobyl as well and had a really powerful performance in that. So he has been cast in a role in Eternals, and we also know that Jim Chang, is also going to be back in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Though the majority of the opinion is that she's not playing her same character from Captain Marvel.
Yeah. For those that seen Captain Marvel, Gemma Chang was one of the... She was the female Kree soldier
Jude Law's right-hand woman, basically.
Yeah, yeah, that was her. But apparently she is not...
biggest fan.
Yeah. She's not going to be the same character in this movie. And the early word is that she is the lead, the female lead of the movie. And I think Barry is the male lead, which when you say that, it's like, well, they brought all those people out on stage and none of them were the lead. Well, apparently not. So
how you get Selma Hayek and you introduce her as the leader of the Eternals and then say she's not the lead of the film, or you have Icarus, who in the comics, his famous thing is that he loves Athena, who is played by Angelina Jolie, and that one of the reasons they can't be together is because Athena likes to move from the human world to other worlds. So if you're going to do that, I mean, there are stories to tell with just the characters you introduced at D23. Why you need to add two more in and call them leads, I have no idea.
Yeah, I don't know enough about Eternals to like say one way or another.
Although Chloe Zhao, she's a very capable director who will do great things, albeit she does always and has always looked like she's 15, but she is a very powerful filmmaker with a lot of really resonant things to say, and giving her this kind of exposure and this kind of a canvas to paint on, I think is going to be really beneficial, especially when you have two other directors on that set in Selma Hayek and Angelina Jolie.
Yeah, I forget about that part of it.
Unbroken.
Yeah.
A Mighty Heart. Jolie had a very specific genre of film she enjoyed doing when studios would give her money to make them.
Well, they'll probably be giving her some more after.
Yeah, this does kind of have that paycheck feel to it for me from her.
Like Maleficent, the second Maleficent comes out this year, and then this one, yeah, it looks like the paycheck year, which is not. Nothing wrong with that.
No, not at all. Not at this point. When it's hard for actresses over a certain age to get roles, and that she's still able to command not only roles, but lead roles and lead money, is still a very impressive thing.
Agreed.
So they're set to start shooting in October. Or no, actually, I think they were supposed to start shooting in August this month.
Either one.
I think it was August, and then I think Shang-Chi was supposed to start shooting in January.
Well, Shang-Chi's not coming out until 2021.
February of 21.
So,
but that would be a little over a year out if you start shooting in February. Start shooting in November, sorry.
I mean, Black Widow started shooting in May for a year.
For a May release.
This one will start shooting between August and November.
For a November release. So you would think you would do a little bit early so that when you do your reshoots and your visual effects that you're going to have for the Eternals.
So, well, they'll do their normal 3-4 month shoot. So, let's say September, October, November, December, they wrap right around the time, the holiday break. And then they go, they'll probably go until the summer and then do reshoots then and then finish it up. That's typically how it goes. They shoot 4 months, there's like 3 months of them post and stuff. And then like after that 3 months, there's like 2 weeks to a month where they reshoot. It's
generally 4 months of prep, 4 months of shooting, and 4 months of post plus reshoots.
Yeah.
And then P&A for 2 months.
It's about, they're all on their schedule.
Yeah. Especially Marvel, who has that schedule down pat and has reshoots built in.
Uh-huh. They're smart.
Indeed. So, Chad, speaking of somebody else who is smart, Netflix. Netflix thinks that they are very, very, very smart. Because you know what they did, Chad?
What'd they do?
They gave Martin Scorsese $200 million.
Oh.
They gave Martin Scorsese $200 million to turn I Hear You Paint Houses into a film. We're going to get the story of Jimmy Hoffa. It's only been done one other time on a major, major scale with Beatty back in the day.
Yeah.
But we're going to get another mobster movie with 3 actors being digitally de-aged for 45 minutes on screen. Your thoughts, sir, on the first trailer for The Irishman?
I mean, I saw it. It's like, it looks just like every other mob movie. I know that might be blasphemy to some of y'all. Fine, whatever. I generally like the mob movies when I see them, but the trailer just looks like every other mob movie with the draw of being of De Niro, Pacino, and Pesci all in them. And then they're all, I mean, the significant one we saw was De Niro, DH, but they're all DH to some extent. That's the biggest draw of the trailer so far. So if, with that, I'm like, okay, that's fine. I'm probably going to watch it at some point. It just, it didn't light my world on fire.
3 hours, Chad. I can guarantee you at least 3 hours. He'll probably have a 4-hour cut of this thing the way he had with Wolf of Wall Street. And I still, for the life of me, want to know what content was cut from Wolf of Wall Street to take it from not only a 4-hour cut to a 3-hour cut, but also take it from an NC-17 to an R.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
So, I mean, I'm excited. I'm pumped. Next time we have Jim on the podcast, I'm going to get him to talk at length about it because, you know, mob movies and the Hoffa thing and all that is really up his alley. Mm-hmm. But I think this is a different animal than Public Enemy or Black Hat or, not Black Hat, Black Mass.
Black Mass, yeah.
Black Mass or Public Enemy, where you are dealing with mobs and stories. The Scorsese name alone, while it won't draw people to a movie about 17th century monks, will draw people to a mob movie that has Pacino, De Niro, and Pesci that's going to land on your Netflix account at some point.
Yeah.
And they spent money to promote the movie on the Oscars the year before their movie is eligible. Like, they are going to do a hell of an advertising buy for this movie. Which is another reason why it boggles in my mind that they gave him $200 million. Because there's no way in hell they're ever going to make that back.
No way.
Because this is why studios would not give him that check. Because there was no way they could financially make money off of it. When you start at a place of $150 to $200 million, that's comic book territory.
Yep.
That's Avengers territory. And those films can do it because when you pump back $2.5 billion plus merchandise sales,
mm-hmm.
you're going to make your $200 million back. When you are a mob movie, starring those 3 actors at $200 million, you're maybe lucky on a full domestic release the size of what they just did for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood with Sony. You maybe make $50 million if you're really lucky. Like, $50 to $60 million total run. Tarantino is getting the most run of his career off of this, and he may hit $100 million.
He'll hit
$100 million. Like, even if you have that level of success, $100 million on a budget of $200 million where you, in Hollywood math, you always have to double your production budget and your advertising budget to turn a profit. You have to make at least $400 million. There's no way in hell that movie, at 3 hours long, with those actors in a mob setting telling that story, is going to make $400 million. Mm-hmm. The only reason Wolf of Wall Street made the movie that it made is because it's bombast and it's sex and it's drugs and it's DiCaprio and it's, you know, the fun movie and all of that. Like, I'm excited by the trailer. I'm compelled by the alternate history narrative that he's presenting there. I'm anxious to see what unfettered, you know, Scorsese looks like again. But I want to know what Netflix was thinking, because there's, I mean, short of app publicity, which you get all the time with Stranger Things and Glow and other deals, mm-hmm. what are you exactly going to get out of this? Because, I mean, if Roma cannot win you the Oscar, you're not going to win it with this. Because Roma proved to me that there is a certain set of members of the Academy, while everything is kind of shifted and changed, that are stuck on the I hate streaming bandwagon. And they're not moving off of it. So then you have to really vote count and do a whip count throughout the rest of the Academy to determine whether or not you have a legitimate shot, because you're going to go spend, Netflix spent gods of money, one of the largest ad buys in history, one of the largest award plays in history for Roma, and still came up short of Best Picture. So if you've already spent $200 million to make the movie, Roma costs a third of that, if that. And you did a huge ad buy for Roma. Well, now you're going to have a larger budget movie with a larger name cast that you're all going to have to put out for acting nominations and producing nominations and directing nominations and everything else. So you're going to have to do another huge awards play. And then you have to hope that you have enough votes within the society to become the first streamer to win the Oscar, because that's clearly your intent for Best Picture. Because if you come short of Best Picture, people are, the next day in the Hollywood Reporter and the trades, all it's going to be about is how stupid and laughable you were because you came up short. So, like, I really would like to know what the feasibility is and what the financial angle is and what the theory or thinking for Netflix is on The Irishman. Because mathematically, there's no way you're going to turn a profit, and the chances of you winning an Oscar for Best Picture, which come traditionally with some bump. Mm. I mean, ask Green Book. It gets some bump from being the Academy Award winner for Best Picture, but you don't get that big of a bump.
No.
The other thing, too, is those films, like, Roma was not part of the marathon that I attended for the Best Picture because Netflix didn't want it in theaters. They had their 1 week qualifying run that they had to have, and that was it. Scorsese's been on record as saying, I want a robust theatrical run. Well, what does a robust theatrical run look like, and how much money is that going to run you?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really interested in The Irishman for a whole host of reasons.
I'm still, once you put the numbers out there, how much it costs, it's like, I don't see Netflix play.
And the only reason that those numbers are that high is because you have to have the de-aging for 45 minutes. If you could do that story with casting younger actors, it would probably be cheaper.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what Ford Coppola did with Godfather Part II, right? You're telling the story of a young Vito Corleone, but you didn't go get Brando to do it. You went and got De Niro to do it.
Mm-hmm.
A young, fresh-faced De Niro that looked similar enough to what you would think a young Brando had looked like, and you did it that way.
Yeah.
So Chad, DC and Ava DuVernay put out some information on the New Gods. Your thoughts on the casting announcements for a movie that'll come out after the Eternals and be eternally mocked.
So, yeah, the reason I put this one on there is strictly because she said that Darkseid is going to be in New Gods.
For those who keep track at home, this was the Darkseid that was supposed to be the main antagonist of Justice League Part 2 under Zack Snyder.
Yep.
All hail the Snyder Cut.
Yep. For those that don't know, Darkseid is the ruler of a planet called Apocalypse.
Which you glimpsed briefly in Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice.
Yeah, so you've seen what Apocalypse should look like. He's in an eternal war with the New Gods. And he's a world conquering type. So the problem with this is we're fresh off of Endgame, and where in the comics Thanos came after and was inspired by Darkseid, we're gonna have the opposite effect here in the movies, because now the minute Darkseid sets foot on screen, people are gonna say it's Thanos, or worse yet, we're ripping off Thanos. They're ripping off Thanos. Now I know Ava DuVernay's got she's tapped Tom King to write the script. Tom King wrote the latest version of Miracle Man, who deals heavily with New Gods, and Darkseid is a part of that, and it's a really fantastic story. If you haven't read it, I suggest you do if you like comics. But the problem still remains that Darkseid is going to be a problem to major audiences, because he looks like and his motivations are going to be similar to Thanos. And that's all people are going to see. But my broader point about this with DC is that they make me tired. They completely make me tired, because I tried to defend them. And clearly,
sir, there is no strategy.
Nothing. There's nothing.
Which you can't really blame them right now.
Yeah, I can.
Well, no, there's no leadership there, right? Roller Coaster Man was embroiled in a controversy for the last 4 months of his reign. And now you've just got someone new settling into the role who's being asked every day on Twitter to release the Snyder Cut. So, I mean, applause to them for hiring a woman with a very strong background to be in this position. But, there's not been a leadership change at Disney. Iger has been there the entire time that Marvel's had been over there. Alan Horn's been over there the entire time. Feige's been the head creative control there over there the entire time. Remember back, we're old, we've been doing this podcast long enough to remember the days when Geoff Johns was supposed to be the savior of all mankind from the Snyder Cut.
Yeah.
So, you've gone through multiple leadership changes going all the way back to when Nolan was being begged to do a Justice League movie. They lost the war. Now they have to figure out a new way forward, and no one has a way forward except let's throw some money at it and try and win some more awards.
See, it's deeper than that. Because it's... Okay, so for example, I'm in one of these Facebook groups I'm in. The discussion of Superman, his viability as a movie character, as a movie franchise came up. And someone commented that if you think that WB hasn't done their market research it's shown that Superman is not viable on movies right now, then you're crazy. And when I read that, the person that said it, I trust them and I know that they know stuff. But this movie company does not know. I think it's a self-fulfilling prophecy with them. Because they do not know how to handle this IP that they have in the form of all of their DC comics, with the exception of Batman. They understand Batman. Batman's an angry little boy that dresses up like a bat that beats up people. And you can spin that any kind of way, and you can still have a viable movie. They understand that. Outside of that, every other success they've had has been completely outside of their control. I will stick with Superman. Because once this happened, I started looking into it, and I eventually will write this out at some point. But so since Christopher Reeve's Superman 4,
Quest for Peace,
there have been
Superman Returns.
Well, no, there have been 5 attempts to do Superman movies from that point until Superman Returns. There was. a proposed Superman 5 with Christopher Reeve. In that movie, the proposed plot involves Superman dying. Then there moves on to
Superman Lives.
There's another one before Superman Lives. In that, the plot of that is Superman dies. Then it moves on to Superman Lives, which is Tim Burton and Nicolas Cage, and in which the plot of which is Superman dies. Mind you, that movie got the furthest along with the director that the same studio said, you took the character that we understand to be a dark, broody, mad little boy and made a movie that is too dark and too weird. We can't have you come back. And they put him on Superman with, again, the same plot of Superman dies. So then there's one other one in which, I think this one came first. The original proposed Batman vs. Superman, in which that one, out of the ones that I've seen so far, that one was the best one. Guess what it doesn't include? Superman died.
Death of Superman.
And then there is J.J. Abrams' Superman Flyby, in which Krypton doesn't blow up, Lex Luthor is a Kryptonian, but surprise, surprise, Superman dies.
Yeah, we had this conversation when Dawn of Justice, we started getting the indication this is where they were going with Dawn of Justice, that the studio has had a hard-on for 20-plus years of doing some version of Death of Superman.
And when we said that, I knew about Lives, and I knew about Flyby. I didn't know about these other ones. And this is almost through 20 years, and their common theme is, we just want to kill him because we don't know what else to do. So then we get to Superman Returns. And guess what? There is a point where it's like, Superman is dead.
But then, Chad, he has the resurrection of the Jesus after creepily looking into Lois Lane's window.
Yeah. Yeah. So they killed him but didn't kill him in Returns.
Did the Batman thing. Yeah. Nolan's Batman thing.
Yeah. Then we get Man of Steel, which is finally out of all of them, it's probably the best pitch.
Yeah. Superman of Superman.
Yes. And then they follow that by, again, what do they want to do? Kill him. This has been through 20 years, various heads of leadership. The constant is the studio itself does not understand the properties they have. And instead of saying, okay, before the 2000s, for them to keep trying to do what they were doing, that's the studio way they knew, that's fine. But once you see that this becomes like an IP game, and the people that are having the success with the IPs that people resonate with, that draw close to the IP, at that point, the leadership needs to say, okay, I know we're the auteur studio, and we can still be that. However, we need to make money, and we have this IP. We need to get a person that at least understands and respects the IP. They don't have to be a comic book person, but they understand what the IP, the value of the IP, and they respect it enough to treat the IP with the respect that it's going to need to be profitable. And put that person over the IP and be like, I don't care what you do, you just do with this IP. And then you come tell me about it. And that's it. It doesn't have to be the Marvel way. It can be completely different. They can be a shared universe. It doesn't have to be a shared universe. It doesn't matter. It needs to be somebody over that IP that respects it to the point that they're going to let the IP be the IP and not try to do something because they don't understand it. And Warner Brothers is not at that point. There are in flux with the leadership because Roller Coaster Man, you know, had his thing, and now we have the new head. And they're also in flux because they were recently bought by AT&T. And with mergers comes fluctuations in different corporate mandates and all that stuff. So they are in a state of flux. But every movie, like, they've lucked into Wonder Woman. They've lucked into Aquaman. They lucked into Shazam. Because they lucked into people that respected the IP and did what they wanted with it. They can't keep lucking up into directors. They need somebody to to vet the directors and be like, okay, I see that you have that respect and we can do it. They can't just like keep lucking into it. And they're not at that point, and it frustrates the hell out of me. And we're probably going to still keep seeing these flip-flops in good, bad movies. And then movies just made to, you know, set the fan base on fire, like The Joker.
Well, and we're going to get an Aquaman sequel at some point, though it won't be Juan's next film. And we will get Wonder Woman 2, which is already set for next summer. And, I mean, the major concern that I have with them right now is Shazam made good money, but was it enough money for them? Because it wasn't a billion-dollar movie. It was a, $250 million?
It made over $300, but it didn't have to be a billion-dollar
movie. Right. No, your franchise starters shouldn't be expected to be.
Yeah, it should have done better than it did, because I think it's one of their better movies. But it didn't, but it did enough for them to do a sequel and probably like take better care.
And very, very easily tease Black Adam in the bonus features of the film.
Yeah.
So, I get it. I just think that they're going to continue on this current path of just making movies. We're going to just make... This guy comes to us with a good pitch for this art house version of the Joker. Here's the check. You know, Patty comes to us with a story for Wonder Woman 2. Well, here's the check. You know, James has a story for a trench movie, just based on the trench of elements of Aquaman. Here's the check. Like, I don't think there's going to be a rhyme or a reason or a strategy. I just think it's going to be, here's the check. We like your pitch. Here's the check.
If they keep having a string of success like that, then it won't matter. But as of right now, I mean, the people that go see these movies don't trust them.
You're almost in Transformers territory.
Yeah.
Which killed Bumblebee.
Yeah.
Bumblebee is the most Transformers movie, the best Transformers movie made yet. But it was stuck in a December with Aquaman, which sucked up all the oxygen in the box office. And, you know, it just never found that audience the way you would like for it to find the audience. And now that puts all the other things you might want to do with the Transformers franchise on hold.
The thing that keeps them from being in Transformers territory is, you know,
Wonder Woman. That you have Patty.
Wonder Woman, Aquaman.
You have Patty and James.
Yeah.
You have Patty and James. And those two are brand name household filmmakers that are our tours that you can hand a check to and let them do their ideas.
Yeah, but it's the movies around that are going to dictate it. Like, and them not going to Comic-Con, while financially it might work out for them, it to a lot of people is like they have no faith.
You were going to do the Wonder Woman spread anyway. There's going to be an Entertainment Weekly spread with pictures from Wonder Woman 84 at some point in November. So why not just go? You don't even have to do a whole Warner Brothers panel. You could have just done a Wonder Woman 1984 panel.
You didn't even have to do...
Look what Paramount did. Paramount doesn't bring their entire slate. They just bring Terminator.
Of their comic releases in the next year, Wonder Woman is the one they needed to worry about the least. And when they said they weren't coming, I was like, that's fine, because there's only Wonder Woman. I that's fine. But we forget. I mean, not forget.
Birds of Prey?
Joker's coming. And a lot of people are skeptical about that. You could have brought something to appease that.
Joker
is not for that crowd.
No, Joker is not for Comic-Con. Joker is for the art house, Venice Film Festival.
Yeah, and again, that's fine.
And then Birds of Prey.
That their whole take of, you know, making like talking down to comic book fans about it is the thing that I like least about that movie. And they keep doing it, but, you know, if it comes back to bite them, it comes back to bite them. I don't think it will, which sucks. But Birds of Prey, nobody knows that movie's coming out. People that know that it's coming out don't believe it's coming out because they don't believe Warner Brothers.
And they don't see any stills. And
there's nothing.
And Robbie didn't even get really asked about it on the abbreviated Once Upon a Time
tour. See, nobody's even thinking about it. And the movie's done shooting. They finished it like a couple months ago. So show something, because that one comes out in February. That one needs the most help, but nothing.
Indeed. All right, so that'll about do it for this week's podcast. Chad has all of his anger out now.
No, not really, but okay.
So we appreciate you listening to our podcast. Be sure to like us and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and we hope that you have a wonderful evening.